Hello, I'm Joss Stone. Thanks for joining me for A Cuppa Happy. I spent the last few years singing my songs in every country in the world and been lucky enough to meet incredible people from all walks of life. What really struck me is that no matter where we are, we're all on the same mission. We're all just trying to find our version of happy. So with this podcast, I'm going to be speaking to a whole host of people to dig deeper into the what, why, and how of this emotion we call happiness. I hope that with these conversations, you discover something to help you on your own quest for happiness, possibly change your mind on a few things, and along the way, share a good old laugh with me and my guests. Today's guest is the author of the book, The Psychobiotic Revolution. Psychobiotic refers to the bacteria in our gut that affects our mental health. Not something you thought about? Me neither. But this is massive for our happiness and is largely overlooked. So I'm happy to have Scott on to educate us, as he really is a world authority on this subject. The episode is jam-packed with info that will surprise you. We find out how some of the gut bacteria are controlling our cravings, the evolutionary reasons why we are all attracted to our partners by smell, and how fecal transplants will be the future. I really think you guys are going to learn a lot from this. Here's Scott C. Anderson. Hello, Scott. How are you?
Fantastic. Thank you. How are you, Joss?
Very, very well. I'm all the better for speaking with you. We've had a little bit of a technical difficulty, so it's nice to finally be able to chat. So I really would like to talk to you about your book because I think it's going to make people happier, which is the main focus here that we have. And the book is called Psychobiotic Revolution. Very cool. My sister's read it like from back to front, front to back, and was raving. So when I heard all about it, I thought, oh, I've got to ask him all these millions of questions. But before that, I was told by Rich that you wrote the first educational piece of software published by Apple called Supermap.
That's right.
Now,
that's right.
What is
that? That goes back a ways.
Yes, I thought it might. So I thought, let's go back and figure out who is this guy writing software? What is it?
Well, The program that we wrote for Apple was called Supermap, and it was actually a way for kids to learn about the United States. And so it had maps and it had quizzes and it had lots of things that we did that were kind of interesting. None of it was a programmatic difficulty for me, but when we took it to show it to the people there, Steve Jobs was there, and they were a very young company. And I gave my demo on my knees because they did not have enough chairs to go around. And then when they saw the map, they said, "What's that?" And I said, "What's what?" And they said, "You've got yellow." Oh. I said, "Yeah, don't you guys know how to make yellow on your computer?" They said, "No." And it turned out that we had mixed the colors in a way that they had never seen before. So they weren't necessarily excited so much about our great software. They just couldn't believe that we had yellow.
Oh, how funny.
And so we showed them a little bit more about how to get these different colors. That when Steve Wozniak made the computer, he said, "I could save 50 cents off of this if I get rid of the color." So he tried to kill the color, but he couldn't quite kill it. And that's what we all ended up using, was this little artifact that we found in one little bit that allowed us to get colors that they weren't getting. So that turned out to be one of those fortuitous events that they were like, okay, that's not what I had in mind, but that worked. So that was a lot of fun. And then I came out here to Ohio because I had a chance to work with some horses, and I really love horses. And so these horses were suffering and nobody knew why. These are the top athletes in the world. And yet they were having problems sometimes. And we decided that there was something unseen that was happening. And so we started to look into their guts to see if there was something going on there. And we found out that there were ulcers in there, which wasn't stomach ulcers or something that was known by veterinarians. But we decided that they probably had colonic ulcers too. And nobody thought that was true. And partly that's because you can't look at a horse's colon without evacuating it. And by the time you evacuate it, the horse is practically dead. Right. They need to eat all the time. So the only place that we saw this was at necropsies. When a horse would die, we would look at it. And that's when we found out that indeed that a large number of over 50% of these horses had colonic ulcers as well.
Was this the little spark before you wrote the book?
Yes, it was before. And it was the spark because we said, what's going on? Why are these horses, they actually look depressed. So you can see a horse, you know, that's got his ears up and his eyes are bright. And then you can see them kind of rolling around on the ground and hangdog expressions. And you don't want to, as a scientist, you try not to anthropomorphize too much. But these were depressed horses. And I started to think there was some sort of a connection between the gut bacteria, their colonic ulcers, and their mood. And I searched around in the literature and I came across this word psychobiotic. And it turned out to be describing exactly that. Here are bacteria that can affect the mood of animals.
So I hear the term the gut-brain axis.
Yes.
What is that?
It's kind of strange, and we're still trying to figure it all out. So there's not necessarily a clear answer for your question, which is sad.
But, it's okay. I've noticed in the science world there's a lot of theories.
There are a lot of theories. Now, just because it's a theory doesn't mean it's not true. Some of these studies that have been done now with germ-free animals. So this is the thing. This was the magic that started this whole thing off, was they have germ-free mice. And they are born by C-section. Everything's very antiseptic. And these mice come out. They have no bacteria whatsoever.
That's weird.
And the idea was to just see, if you want to know what bacteria are doing, let's start with an animal that has none and see how it's different.
See, I thought that we were like a lot of what we are is bacteria, or is that just a myth?
Yes. So it's very difficult to be without bacteria. And you have to live, they have to be in special worlds where there aren't any other bacteria around,
sure,
because they will get killed. The bacteria, without your own bacteria providing protection,
right,
the outside world bacteria will get you.
Wow.
And so it's a tricky thing. So when these animals are raised in a highly hermetically sealed environment, all their food is sterilized and everything, so they're in a bacteria-free world,
wow,
which is very difficult to do with any other animal. Mice are about the only animals that we've done well with.
Okay.
And they found out that these mice had a different response to stress.
Huh.
They were just, it was unexpected. Nobody thought that would be one of the issues. And so they started looking into this and said, well, what in the world? What do bacteria have to do with your mood? You know, basically, these mice were kind of scurrying around. Some of them were had a high response to stress. Uh-huh. But at other times, they were carefree and they would go into places that other mice wouldn't. So it was a confusing message, and when it needed to be, you know, narrowed down a little bit. So what ultimately they found was that there are at least three different ways that the brain connects to the gut. So this gut-brain axis is partly through the vagus nerve, which is a nerve that goes from the brain down to all the internal organs, and along the way it goes to the gut. And the gut has a huge, like a tube sock of a brain of its own. So if you take the gut out, it can still do peristalsis, it can still move, it's on its own. It doesn't really need any input from the brain in order to work.
Huh.
But there is a connection, it's just not clear. And certainly we can't hear our bacteria talking to our brain, and we can't hear our brain talking back. It's a two-way street.
Right.
So the brain talks to the gut, and the gut talks back to the brain. And the language, what they're talking about is, what's going on in the gut? What's happening? Do I have pathogens in here? If I have pathogens, then I need to get rid of them. And I have to alert the brain right away to find a bathroom quickly. This is the communication that we're talking about between the gut and the brain. It's pretty low-level stuff. They're not discussing Freud.
No.
Part of the problem with all of this is that it's so quiet that you really don't know what's even going on. So this is a communication that's happening continuously, but it's just in a different world, in a different, very quiet language. Yeah. So the other way is that when you get stressed, you produce cortisol. And cortisol is one of those, it's the stress hormone. Mm-hmm. And it also can affect your gut. And your gut can then talk to your brain about what's going on, which can also cause cortisol. So almost all of these things are circular. Almost all of them have feedback loops in them.
Wow.
And like a feedback loop in music, sometimes it can get to a fever pitch and all of a sudden you can't hear anything, right?
Yeah.
That's when you're really sick. And you can create panic attacks in people. Mm-hmm. Simply by doing some of this stuff, by giving them certain chemicals, cortisol is one of them. And you can give them little teeny bits of bacteria, and it causes your system to freak out in such a way And the third way of communication, so we've got the cortisol system, we've got the vagus nerve, and then the third one is using the immune system itself. Okay. So your immune system, we always think of our immune system as helping to protect us against the outside environment. But in fact, it's your bacteria that are the first line of defense. So your bacteria, your good bacteria, are helping and fighting off against the pathogens that enter the world. And then your immune system maybe hears about it. And then it starts to do its thing, and it changes the gut bacteria, which in turn can change your brain. All of this stuff is hooked together in such a way that it is mind-boggling to think of all the gears that are turning all the time, right, and how many systems are involved in all of this. So one of the reasons that this research has taken so long to get where it is that you have to have gastroenterologists talking with neurologists, talking with endocrinologists, talking with immunologists, all these different specialties. And they're not used to talking to somebody else out of their field, right? It's like, why is a gut guy listening to a brain guy about the gut? It's like, what do you know?
All part of the same body, guys. We've got to come together.
Yes. So there's that holistic thing that's happening there.
Yeah.
That's really cool to see.
So why doesn't, if all this information is coming into your gut and there's all these like little buddies in there that are fighting off the bad guys, basically, in different ways.
Yes.
Why is it that when we have, say, I don't know, that bad feeling in your tummy, that gut feeling that says, run, you know, or don't be in here, or, oh my God, that guy's not good for you, or whatever. Why do we ignore it? Is our brain winning and our gut's losing?
Is your brain losing? I think is, well, in that case, we've seen some really good evidence that bacteria can affect your cravings.
Ah, yes. Okay.
So you think you like that donut, but it's actually a species of bacteria in your gut that says, I like those donuts. This is what I really want. And if you give me a donut, I'll produce dopamine and make you feel good.
Evil little bacteria.
Bacteria have access to neurotransmitters. These are the chemicals that we use in our brain, like serotonin and dopamine and all these things that people use when they're depressed. You get things that are trying to build up your serotonin, build up your dopamine levels and make you feel better.
Yep.
Bacteria can produce these same chemicals. What in the world are bacteria doing with these brain chemicals? They don't have brains. And it turns out they're probably using these same signals as our brains do because it's evolutionarily conserved. It goes way back in time when bacteria and eukaryotes, the normal animals, had a similar way of talking to each other. So the bacteria are probably talking to each other, but they are also probably talking to us. And that's one of the things we think is going on, is that when you feed them certain things, they will feed you dopamine, and then you will start to get addicted. This is why you didn't make a choice somewhere along the line to say, I like crullers, I like scones.
Or I like that person that's really bad for me. That's the one. Because something happens in your stomach, I think, definitely.
Yeah, there's something in your stomach. The more I deal with this, the more I find everything seems to come from the gut.
Isn't it funny?
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
But we can smell people.
Oh, yeah.
And the smell kind of clues us in to whether they are going to be compatible with us or not.
Oh.
And that's a really interesting thing, too. We found that you can give, this is some of the stuff is from fruit flies. So we're looking at all kinds of different animals, but they give fruit flies, a group of fruit flies live on honey and another group lives on starch. And those two, after a while, they don't like each other anymore. Even though they're the same kind of fly, they smell the other one. They say, you stink. You're not my honey type.
Oh, really?
And so they end up almost speciating. They almost end up becoming two different species because they just don't want to be with each other. What you're seeing is their gut bacteria have changed in order to accommodate this new food. So somehow along the line, we're looking at the potential for these gut bacteria to affect our love lives.
Yes.
Which is bizarre.
So it's interesting because there's all these little different tips and tricks to be happier. And everybody has their little different way of being happy. Sometimes it's music, sometimes it's conversation, sometimes it's God, I don't know. You know, but to have all these ideas that you've written about, your little rules to follow, can you tell us about some good rules to follow to help your gut help you be happy and stop that depression just sinking in. Because it does it to all of us, you know. It gets us at one point or another.
Yes. And, you know, some situations are just depressing. So you have to kind of have your BS detector has to be turned on, because there are people who are going to try and tell you that you should just cheer up or something like that. And it's like, no, sometimes you need to work through it. Mm-hmm. But if there's no real reason, if you can't put your finger on why you're depressed, then that's when you might want to think about your gut, because it's so hard. You can't tell really any other way except that you're depressed for no other reason. And so what is the answer to that is what we think is that a lot of this has happened recently, in the last 150 years or so, where our diets changed. And what we did was we got rid of fiber. We said, oh, look, if you take the fiber out of the flour, you get this beautiful white flour. It makes these wonderful cakes and white breads and all this white stuff. Yep. And that's...
I do love a bit of that. But you're going to break my dreams now. Bust my bubble. Tell me I can't have my cakes. No, I'm kidding.
You can certainly have your cake. Just don't eat it.
So we ruined our flour. Go on.
Yeah, we everything. We added sugar to everything. Everything. Am I breaking another bubble?
Yes, you are.
I'm sorry. Sorry about this. It turns out that all of these things you can accommodate to. Right. You can adjust to these things. Mm-hmm. And so it's really worth trying. You probably don't eat as much salt as you used to eat. Oh. Have you cut down on salt a little bit? A lot of people have, and they thought they would never live through it, but they did.
It's not bad, is it? You can change your diet. You just have to go through a process.
Yes, and that process is involved with convincing your microbes that it's okay to do what we're doing.
Your microbes
are like, I want that donut. And you're like, no, we're not having the donut. I want the donut, says the microbe. And so you have to show who's boss. You have to say, look, you're not my favorite microbe. Okay, you're screwing up my life. We've got other microbes. They are interested in fiber. And the fiber turns out to be the preferred food for the good bacteria living in your gut.
Okay.
And that's what we've taken out of our food. So if you go to Africa, you'll be getting like maybe 50 grams of fiber a day. In America, people are lucky to get even 10 grams.
Oh, really?
And as a consequence, it screws up your entire microbiota. The microbiota is the group of microbes that live together. And it's a big city down there. And it's very complex. The different bacteria depend on other bacteria to coexist. And it's like a city where you know, the cobbler is dealing with the person who is, you know, needs shoes, who is dealing with the person who needs
together.
Music. Mm. Yeah. And so all these bacteria have these different roles to play. And when you go in and start changing things, like you pull out the fiber, it's like going in and mowing down the forest in a jungle and saying, well, now what did we do? Well, you really mess it up. And that's what we're doing, is we're all living with messed up guts. And the answer is to start eating fiber. Now, if you start doing that, first thing that may happen is you might notice a little gas. So I'm not going to sugarcoat that. So there's a little bit of that, but we like to say that farts are funny. Depression is not. The key to all of this is things like beans. There's other things, though, that also are full of fiber that are not necessarily obviously full of fiber. Asparagus has got a lot of fiber. Artichokes are very, very high in fiber.
Nice.
Onions and garlic and a lot of just great food has a lot of fiber in it. So basically vegetables. You will not find any fiber in meat. So it's a total vegetable thing. That's not to say that meat's not good for you. Meat has other purposes, but it's not going to provide fiber for your diet. And we're kind of very leaning heavily toward the vegetable side with all of this. So it's more like a vegetarian diet. Probably there's a vegan way to approach this as well, but vegans have to have a lot of discipline in order to pull it off. You've got to make sure you're getting your vitamin B12s and your iron, and it's hard if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah. I tried to be vegan once on the road. That was a mistake. I was vegan for about 2 weeks and oh my goodness, Scott, I was so hungry.
Yes.
Because I didn't know what to eat because, you know, you're traveling and not everyone understood that at that time. Now it's easier, I think, because they've got more cafes and they make beautiful food. But that's only where we live, you know. What
well,
about the rest
here
of the world?
In Ohio, it was a tough thing too. But, you know, Chrissy Hines set up a vegan restaurant here. Yeah.
And good old Chrissy. She's on that hardcore, isn't she?
Absolutely.
Wow.
And it was a fantastic restaurant. I think that it failed because after a while, it's just there weren't enough vegans. But we're pretty sure if she started that now, that it would be a big hit. So we're inviting her back. Come back, Chrissy.
Okay, so the study on the flies. I have to ask you a question about romantic couples. So if the flies went off, they went off each other because one of them had a different bacteria to the other.
Right.
Does that mean that if one couple or one half of a couple is taking medication that impacts their brain or their physical health, like their mental health, like an antidepressant or something like that, could that affect their microbiome and consequently their attraction to each other, their vibe with the other person?
Antidepressants are notorious, actually, for affecting your libido and your weight. And the studies have now shown that indeed what's happening is your gut microbes are being radically affected by some of these antidepressants, some more than others. But that's why you see a lot of people taking antidepressants and instantly putting on 10, 20, 30 pounds. And so it can by reference can affect your libido as well. But those are indirect effects. There's direct effects on your libido sometimes with some of these drugs. And so that's one of the things that you should know. One of the reasons that Ted Dynan is involved with this research is he's a psychiatrist, and he actually has patients who say, I don't want to take these drugs. These are powerful drugs, and they're really affecting all parts of me that I don't want to have affected. Right. And he's actually started to prescribe prebiotics and probiotics to some of his patients, and it's working.
Okay. I heard about probiotics, because you hear about them, yogurt and all that kind of bits and bobs, Yakult. But what is prebiotic? I don't think I've ever heard of a prebiotic until now.
Well, a prebiotic is food for the probiotics.
Oh.
And so the most common prebiotic is actually fiber.
Oh, so you can't just have a probiotic and not feed him.
Right. You're going to put him down there and he's going to get languishing.
Hungry. Yeah. And he'll be useless.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that
hungry,
makes sense.
Useless and upset, probably.
So you have to have both in order for this to work out.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And in fact, you don't even need the probiotics so much. If you get the proper prebiotics, you will develop the proper probiotics, if that makes any sense. In other words, if you feed them, they'll come.
Huh. Nice. Okay, so instead of the antidepressants, the doctors were prescribing this, which is obviously much healthier. Can the partner that's dealing with the person that's on those probiotics or not, let's say that they're on the drugs, it may be affecting them in a way because of the smell, or can it affect the other person that's nothing to do with them? That they're a physical different body.
I suspect that it can. And this is something that we're still working out. I like you going back to the flies because it's really easy to see with the flies.
Yeah.
Humans, we know that humans are doing this, but it's really hard to do the studies, and we're not getting, there's a lot of noise involved. So it's like, if you ask somebody to sniff somebody, it's not clear that they're getting the right message, right?
Yeah.
But a good research has been done with giving t-shirts. So you give an old sweaty t-shirt to somebody and ask them to identify whose t-shirt it is. And women have been able to do this. I don't think they've done the reverse with men, and I don't know why. But women can identify their guy based upon. And so now
I can definitely do that with my guy for sure.
There you go.
I know if it's my brother's or if it's Cody's.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Whenever I hear that people are having a problem, I say, how does he smell? and it turns out they're like, well, I'm not sure I like it all the time. And I think, dump him, get another guy.
Yeah. It's not right for you. Yeah. He doesn't smell good to you. It's not working out. Or he is taking antidepressants and something dodges in his gut that maybe can be changed.
Yeah, and people can notice it. And it's not clear. I mean, obviously you got issues where people are actually acting differently because you're taking an antidepressant, so you'll start to act differently. And so there's a lot of things involved, and it gets really, really complicated, especially with humans. I think flies maybe have a little simpler life. So humans, when we get to it, it's like one of the things they think that's going on is that there's something called a major histocompatibility complex. I really am sorry I said that.
What is that?
We'll call it MHC.
Okay.
And it's kind of showing off to the rest of the world and to your body what diseases you've already had. And so the idea is that if you can smell somebody's MHCs,
their history, basically.
Yeah, you can smell their history. And so you can know that you want to be complementary to their history. Your genes should complement their genes in such a way that you're covering more diseases, you're taking care of more diseases. So they think this is part of what's happening with the pheromones and what you smell is you might be smelling some of this MHC part. You might be smelling somebody's history of disease.
Weird.
Which is really weird. It's fascinating when you start to look at it that this could be at the root of so many of our relationship issues, is that we're just not quite compatible on that molecular level.
Yeah. That is interesting. There was a study that you spoke about that was conducted on prisoners.
Yes.
And they were administered probiotics and their behavior improved. What do you think happened there? I mean...
Well, I really don't think that that's difficult
to figure
out.
How real was it?
Yeah, I think, first of all, we're not supposed to be experimenting on prisoners. And I don't know exactly why.
Well, then why is there a study on prisoners?
Because it was done somewhere else.
Naughty. It wasn't your study.
No, it was not my study. although I see no real reason why.
Why not? If they sign up for it.
Yeah, if they sign up for it, I don't see what the problem is. The real issue with all of this, and the reason that prisoners and also people who live in mental hospitals, the reason that you see these kinds of studies is that you got total control over their diet. It's really hard to do it any other way. So you do these studies with college students. It's like, all right, we want you to eat just this and this. And it's like, that's a college student.
Yeah, how can you trust them? No, because they might just want to go to a party and...
Yes, and do God only knows what. So it's like, that's exciting, but not necessarily a good study. So that's right. why we like these people who are incarcerated, is that you can actually have total control over their diet. And to the extent that we feed prisoners crap, it's not surprising to me to see that there's bad behavior in the jails. I think part of the reason they're in the jail in the first place is that they had a bad diet. I think that's a part of it. Not all of it. I mean, there's a genetic component to violence, but there's also, I think, a big part of their bad guts, that they're acting out of this anxiety in their life that's actually caused by a bad bacteria. And so if you could offer this up to a prisoner, why wouldn't they want to try it?
Yeah.
I mean, do I just want to be a bad guy forever, or would it be nice to get back into society and get back with my family and stuff? Yeah. So I think this should be an option, and I'm shocked that we're not doing it. But a lot of people are not on board yet with the microbiota. A lot of people doctors today are still being taught without very much education about microbes, except for how to kill it.
Mm. I do wonder why, when you go to the doctors, just a general, your general practitioner, why don't they talk to you about your diet? Why do they talk to you about all the other things and the pills and this and that? Why don't they say, what are you eating? Let me send you to a nutritionist. Let's start there.
Well, the cynic in me says that you can sell them drugs and make a lot of money, but not going to make a lot of money from food. But I don't think that's all of it. I think most of it is that they really just don't know.
They just don't know.
Yeah.
Which is strange, because you go to the doctor and you trust them with your life. So you want them to know. Or at least look it up.
Yeah, Google it, please. When I talk to doctors about it, they're very excited to hear about it.
Of course, yeah.
But they were the first to admit that they don't know anything about it. And so I'm sending doctors, continuously sending them papers that are out there. And they're learning. They're coming around. And they're starting to see, oh, my goodness, this is a really great tool that we've got, that we could actually start giving people probiotics, and that their moods would improve, and lots of things. Their skin could clear up. Lots of things could happen. That would make them happier and healthier people. And the same thing with, as we get older, our bacteria changes as you get older. And it's not just getting weaned, where you all of a sudden stop drinking milk and then you go on to hard food. It's throughout life there's a big change. And it's kind of a continuation of that weaning, where you get less and less of a certain kind of bacteria that is really good for you. And you start to suffer. And so you look in the guts of people, centenarians, the people who live really old and are healthy, they've got a really different gut microbe than other people do. The people that are sick have a very, and the main thing is that it's more diverse. They've got more types of bacteria than other people do. So how do you get a diverse bacteria is by eating a diverse diet. And so if you're like a lot of people, it's like, I'm going to eat meat and potatoes for the rest of my life. It's like, that's a terrible diet.
What if you were just having like vegetables? That's it. No dairy, no sugar, no, apart from obviously the vegetable sugar, but.
Yeah, there's things called phytochemicals, and phyto just means plant. These are things that turn plants' colors. Mm. So if you've got a red potato, if you have a purple potato, they're purple on the inside.
I love those.
I don't know if you've, you got to try a purple
potato.
They are
banging.
They're delicious. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Purple onions. But all those things, the more colorful they are, the more of these phytochemicals they have. So that's what you should choose. You should be choosing things that are dark green or red when you go in. And you should get lots of different colors because each of those colors represents a specific phytochemical. Mm. And these phytochemicals are almost as good as fiber in terms of feeding and diversifying your bacteria.
Interesting. And it looks beautiful on your plate.
And it's gorgeous.
Which is very important. Oh, food is amazing, isn't it? Now, what about a little glass of wine? Do you guys ever dabble in that area? I feel like that's got to be good for your spirit sometimes.
Well, spirits are good for your spirits. I'm not going to burst another bubble, all right? I'll try not to. Well, the problem with alcohol is that, you know, the next day, all the fun that you had the previous night comes back negatively, right?
Yes.
So if you have a little bit, that seems to be okay. But a little bit is shockingly small amount and not nearly enough, especially during the times of COVID. So for a woman, moderate drinking is one glass a night, with the caveat that you really shouldn't be doing it every single night.
You know, I'll tell you a funny story. It's not very funny, actually. It's kind of gross. There was once a time when I offered my poo to a friend of mine. He was mortified. He was like, what are you offering me? And it's because I read an article, a very short, tiny little article in the newspaper that was on the fecal transplant. Now, I know you know a lot about this and you can explain it to us, because my poor friend was absolutely shocked that I would even suggest such a thing. But he had IBS and he'd had it for like 2 years.
Yeah.
And yeah, I guess we need to discuss this. Go on, Doc.
I am shocked that you're the one who brought that up and not me. So the fecal transplants are actually not just are they gross, but they are stunningly successful. And they have shown us something that we don't get very often. Scientists are always saying correlation is not causation. And what that means is you may see that something changes along with something else, so that clearly they're connected somehow. But you don't know if A causes B or if B causes A. You right. just know that they're tied together somehow. But fecal transplants finally gave us a chance to prove that these microbes are causing the behavior. And they did it in an interesting way. They took human fecal matter from depressed people and from non-depressed people, and they gave it to mice. And the mice, these are germ-free mice again, those mice that got depressed human poop became depressed, and the others did not. And so that was perfect. That shows causality. It shows not just that they are associated, but that one causes the other, that bacteria genuinely cause depression. And it not only shows that causality, but it shows it cross species, that depressed human bacteria mm-hmm. can cause depression in a mouse is astonishing. So mm-hmm. there is something going on there, and the fecal transplants are magical. If you have C. diff, and this is where we find the fecal transplants in this country mostly, mm-hmm. C. diff is an infection that you get when you go to the hospital. They give you tons of antibiotics. Mm-hmm. And the last bacteria that's left standing is C. difficile, which is a type of bacteria that can put itself into a little cyst and protect itself against the antibiotics. Oh. So you've killed all of the good bacteria and you've got this one little bacteria left, and it just grows to fill its space, and it's deadly when there's no other bacteria around.
Oh gosh, it sounds like a tumor. You know,
it's really not a good thing. So miserable. And 60,000 people, I think 60,000 people a year die caused by a hospital, basically caused by antibiotics. They'll die from C. diff. And so when you ask them if they want to have a poop transplant, they say, absolutely. I don't care how gross it sounds. And they are fixed within a day, sometimes even within hours. And it's 95% cure rate. So there's hardly any medicine that we know of that works as good as just good old poop.
Wow. And
it is interesting. It's totally fascinating.
How do you separate out the bit that you want from all the other grossness?
Well, they run it through a sieve and they throw it in your blender. Not no, my blender.
No, they don't.
Not my blender. Yes, they do.
Do they?
They sieve it out. But the other thing, now here's the interesting thing, okay, because this is really cool. You have to have a healthy donor.
Yes.
Definitely. You don't want somebody who's sick because you'll get
whatever. You don't want someone that's upset. I didn't realize that you don't want somebody that's in a bad mood.
Right.
You may not want somebody.
Yeah. Yes. So if you get depressed, that's one of the things that now they're thinking they should be asking these people.
You want happy people's poop.
Yes. You want happy poop. And those happy poopers, their poop should be worth gold.
Wow.
I mean, it's just these are people who should probably, yeah. And so now this has become something we really don't know nearly enough about about the success of fecal transplants for improving mood. This is a brand new field, but people are starting to see it. And right now it's anecdotal. It's like, I was depressed, I got a poop transplant, and now I'm happy.
And
it's like,
what the God, that's so mad, isn't it? I need to talk to you about genetically engineering bacteria. What's going on with that? I mean, is that, well, I know it's possible. I've heard about it being possible. What's going to happen in the future with that?
Well, it's kind of interesting. Bacteria are promiscuous, let's say. They hang around with each other and they trade genes. So they'll do this naturally anyway. If they're in a situation, if you've got some sort of bacteria that says, oh, I don't need to digest this particular sugar because my buddy over here is doing it, I'll give you that gene. I'll get rid of it. I don't need it. Then I can save myself some energy and you're making the food that I need and everything's great. So bacteria change genes a lot. In fact, it's ridiculous. If you look at these bacteria, sometimes it's hard to tell what they are because they have traded genes with so many other bacteria that they're kind of a blur. It was back in the 1970s that we first started doing genetic engineering of bacteria. One of the first things that they did was created bacteria that could create insulin. Because insulin was previously coming from cows and it was hard to purify it sometimes.
Okay.
So this has been going on for a while. But what you want now is you want to create bacteria that have the germs that make you happy and have the genes that make you happy. And so we're working on that. And the gene that's going to be the big winner in this is a gene that creates butyrate. And butyrate, the name sounds familiar. It's like butter, and it smells a little bit like butter, only not quite so good. But it turns out to be one of the best foods for the cells lining your gut. And that's how you can fix a leaky gut. So you get this butyrate, and if we can create enough bacteria that can live off of anything that you want to throw at and create butyrate, then that would be a bacterium that could actually make people feel much better.
Oh, wow. I hope that happens soon.
It will.
If you had all the money in the world to do studies, and I mean, I suppose there's so many studies that you'd like to do, but which would be the next one that you would do?
I don't know. There are so many exciting areas. One of them that's interesting is phages. And phages, the word just means eater, and they are viruses. Mm-hmm. So mostly when you talk about the gut, you're talking about bacteria, but it's really microbes of all kinds. Microbe is a bigger term that includes bacteria and fungus and viruses and other little creatures that are squirreling around in your gut. And so the phages are things that actually eat bacteria. They don't eat them per se. What they do is they infect them. So it's like a bacteria gets a cold.
Oh.
The virus burrows in and then it takes over the machinery of the bacteria to create more viruses. And then they explode out of this poor bacteria and go on to reinfect other bacteria. The interesting thing about phages is that they only attack specific bacteria. So if I'm a phage, I am going to go after one specific microbe and that's it. So that's the cool thing about them is that you can selectively kill just the bacteria that you want and no others.
Oh, that is good.
Once they're done, once their host is gone, they disappear too. So they stay around as long as the host is there. So you don't have to take repeated applications of antibiotics or anything. You just take the phage once, it clears the situation up. And they need a lot of work. So there's the money, right? Mm-hmm. Give me the money, we'll make phages work. And then we can really start to target things perfectly.
Oh, I hope that it happens. I hope that you get to do it. I'm sure you will.
We're working on it. Yeah, we're getting there with all of it.
Oh, good. So I wish that I could talk to you longer, actually. You must come back because I've got 1,000,000,000 more questions for you.
Okay.
But the last question, which is important, is how do we figure out if we've got a good gut or a bad gut? How do we know if it's going good or bad?
It's an excellent question because the conversation is so quiet, you know, between the gut and the brain. We can't really tell what's going on. So we don't know if people are upset.
Especially
down there
if you've
or not.
Got all that dopamine going on because you're eating a bunch of chocolate or a bunch right. of donuts. You're like, woo, my life is yeah. great. And actually, nope. It's not going well in there.
You're so partying you know? Tonight, but tomorrow you're suffering.
Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of things. There are certain clues. I mean, for instance, if you are depressed with no other reason, or if you have inflammation, if your joints are creaky, all of these mm-hmm. things, if you've got heart problems, all of these things seem to come back to a leaky gut. So that's one thing. But there's something interesting happening in Israel at the Weizmann Institute. They're doing these studies that are pretty straightforward and interesting in terms of measuring your blood sugars after you eat food. Oh. So now if you eat a donut, your blood sugar shoots up.
Yep.
If you eat sushi, presumably it doesn't because sushi is not, you know, it's not a big carb blast. It's fish. But that's not always true. It turns out that some people will have their blood sugar shoot up with sushi, but they can eat ice cream with no change in sugar levels. So there's something going on. And what they realized was it's the bacteria in your gut. So using the blood sugars, being able to monitor it like diabetics monitor their blood, that actually can show you what's going on in your gut. It can show you, give you a snapshot of what kind of bacteria you have. And these people are using that to then make suggestions to you based upon how your sugar levels respond to your food.
Oh, so it's all individual.
Yeah, this is new, but it's very exciting, and I expect to be doing some work with that soon, because you've got to be able to see it. It's so hard to fix things that you can't
yeah.
see.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming to chat with me. It's been great. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Joss.
So the book is called, what's it called? Psychobiotic Revolution.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Scott. You're amazing. Cheers.
Thank you, Joss.